You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On Election Day 2004, exit polls showed that voters favored President Bush by an 18-point margin over Senator John Kerry on the issue of national security. Those numbers reflect a trend in presidential elections over the past 40 years that favors Republicans in times of crisis. So what does this mean for the Democrats going into the 2008 election? Pulitzer Prize winner, former Obama campaign advisor Samantha Power, has written an article on just that called Democrats and National Security, which appears in the latest edition of the New York Review of Books. And I'm very pleased that it brings Samantha Power back to this program. Hello.
Hi. Good to be back.
When we talk about concepts like national security today, do you think we're actually talking about keeping the country safe, or are we talking about something else?
Well, it depends who the we is, of course. I think it's useful to talk in terms of keeping the country safe, but also to remember that in the 21st century, our ability to do that is going to turn in large measure on our ability to convince others around the world to join us in collaborative, cooperative security efforts. And I think national security also, in an age of melting planets and so forth, has to embody human security. You know, this conception that, the ideal state of the world and certainly of the United States is for civilians to be safe in their person and their countries around the world, and that we're inextricably linked to the fate of other people. If they live in fear, in all likelihood, there's a greater likelihood that we're going to live in fear as well.
Do the polls suggest that national security is a priority among voters in this election?
Well, I mean, it was a very, very big issue at the start of the primary season, and as the economy has sunk and oil prices have risen, those two issues have taken center stage. In fact, a recent poll, I think, showed that terrorism had gone from being the number one issue for, you know, close to half the country to now commanding the number one position with only 4% of American voters. So I think, you know, the temptation is, of course, to talk about the economy day in, day out, and that's exactly what both candidates are doing and probably should be doing. But I think, you know, if Democrats are going to seize upon this, I think, a real opportunity in this election, and not just this election, but going forward, and we've seen it in the 2006 election, that there is a window that voters are looking anew and asking, is this longstanding edge we've given to Republicans, this longstanding reflexive assumption that we've had that, you know, Democrats may be good on the environment and may be good on education, but boy, you can really count on Republicans on national security. As independents and even Republicans waver on that question, this is an opportunity to really drive home Democratic command of national security, 21st century versions of national security for the United States within this larger global context.
But isn't the McCain campaign trying to make national security one of the defining issues of the campaign?
Well, it is. And McCain, of course, is a special candidate. I mean, of all the Republican candidates in the primary season, he's the one who has the most to point to in terms of national security, his own very honorable biography and his long years in the Senate and lots of foreign travel and so forth. So he sees this as really, in some ways, I think, his not only his best chance, for winning and for commanding independent Republican support, but maybe even his only chance, given the state of the economy, given the differences on environment and the fact that he is associated with the Bush administration and a lot of these other issues. So he is trying to drive these differences. And I guess just one of the temptations, or in years past, as we saw it in 2004 and even in 2000, when Al Gore ran with, this terrific CV, service in Vietnam, 7 years on the Senate Armed Services Committee, 4 years on the House Intelligence Committee, crucial in facilitating nuclear disarmament in the former Soviet Union, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And even in 2000, Gore sort of tended not to embrace the national security issues, and Bush was able to ride the long longstanding Republican advantage on national security. And, you know, there's a sense, has always been a sense, I think, of late in Democratic circles that national security is something you avoid like the plague. You know, that you just, you sort of, if you have to talk about it, you hold your nose, you talk about it, you try to survive it rather than to own it. And I just think, again, in the wake of these 8 years, associating John McCain with the positions that he himself has advanced on Iran, on Iraq, of course, on Afghanistan, on Pakistan, all of those positions mirroring those of the Bush administration, making clear, of course, in economic discussions and energy discussions what his positions on those issues have been. But to see that, you know, we're not going to win by willing national security away, you know, that this is something that we have to tackle head on, and that there are actually real advantages to treating like voters as if they're, you know, adults who look at the scoreboard and understand that these policies have been disastrous for not only our standing in the world, but also our long-term security.
You mentioned that John Kerry was a decorated war hero. So was Senator Max Cleland. He also lost in the last election. And the Republicans have been able to claim ownership of national security, I think, ever since Richard Nixon ran in 1968. So why do you think they've been so successful at convincing most of the electorate that they're stronger than the Democrats in this regard, even when they run candidates like George Bush and Dick Cheney, who really never served in the military to speak of?
I think it's an excellent question. Something I have puzzled over for a long time. And so it's one of the motivations for writing this article and trying to understand it better myself. I mean, the stark fact is that since 1968, as you suggest, in times of perceived peril, Republicans have won each and every time, and in times of perceived safety or, you know, greater calm, Democrats have won. And the only exception to that is George Bush in 2000 defeating Al Gore in a time of perceived calm. And I think there are a number of answers that one can come up with. I think, you know, most of your listeners probably have their own account as well, because we've all experienced this as citizens. But one is the particular stories that are told about particular presidents who come to define party identity. You know, the fact is that even though Eisenhower initiated involvement in Vietnam and Nixon extended it, that war is tended over, you know, through history to be planted at the doorstep of John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson in particular.
And the Korean War with Harry Truman, World War II, FDR.
As long as we get to sort of pivot back to Truman and FDR, the Democratic Party, I think, does fine. In those days, there wasn't this substantial, what in the 90s was a 30-point edge for Republicans on national security. I think it was the 60s, as you said earlier, and Vietnam, which marked a kind of threshold event in the American psyche, and that's when Republicans started to amass this ever greater advantage, again, until very recently, on national security. I think Jimmy Carter and the perception that he didn't respond forcefully to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Iran hostage crisis, et cetera. And of course, Ronald Reagan did more to embed this idea of Republicans as being tougher and more reliable on national security, probably than any other single individual. You know, ridiculing Carter for being allegedly soft on communism, denouncing evil. And what's funny is in the national myth, you know, one thinks about Reagan and his denunciations of the evil empire. Turns out that Reagan actually stopped using the language of evil in the last 3 or 4 years of his presidency in the interest of actually sitting down with the Soviets and pursuing arms control talks. And that, of course, contributed as well to detente and to glasnost and to the fall of the wall with which he's credited. So it's, in fact, when Reagan moves away from some of the rhetoric and the saber-rattling that he's known for in the American myth, the kind of John Wayne Reagan, and becomes a more pragmatic Reagan, that's when you start to see, you know, more of a peace dividend. But so I think part of it is just these individuals where you say Republicans, and a lot of people still think of Reagan and bringing down the wall and so forth. Part of it, I think, is that the U.S. military, of course, recruits heavily from the South and from rural areas more heavily than from the coasts and traditionally Democratic areas. Very prominent officers in the military have been Republicans and have self-identified either after leaving the military, or sometimes even you can tell, sort of they make it quite clear while in office. It's been a Christian institution, and until recently, Democrats have been a little self-conscious, I think, in public life, embracing their faith. I think that's changing a good deal, and so the degree to which the U.S. military becomes itself a symbol of Republican command of national security, I think that's changing.
Although we have an odd situation. We had Jimmy Carter, who was from the South, who was a Christian and who was a veteran. And yet, as Matthew Iglesias points out in Heads in the Sand, in each election, the Democratic presidential nominee approaches national security like Charlie Brown in a football. Mm-hmm.
Well, that has been, I think there's a lot of truth to that, and his book is one of the ones that I looked at in the review for that reason. I think he's really on from something. And again, his point is that they just want to pivot and get away from the subject as quickly as possible.
You think that's going to happen in this election cycle with Barack Obama?
No, I don't think you've seen it with Obama over the course of this election at all, actually, up until this point. I think the recent foreign trip is one reflection of that, where a lot of political consultants would have said, don't do it. You know, people are focused on the economy. They're focused on gas prices. If you go abroad, you know, you'll expose yourself to precisely the attacks that came. And Obama, again, consistently, whether on race or on national security, I think has treated the voter, you know, as an adult, and has said people have still recognized that it's very important for the United States to reclaim our standing in the world, to get the respect of other countries. And, you know, they want to see me out there in Iraq and Afghanistan talking to the troops, learning more about what the situation on the ground is, et cetera. I come back also, I mean, more than even the last trip to the primary season. It's very interesting, but for all the similarities between Senator Obama and the other candidates in the race, the issues that he ended up standing out on, I think, for the most part, were issues like, you know, what to do about Pakistan and the, you know, the eastern Afghanistan and the presence of the Taliban, you know, negotiating with dictators or negotiating with our adversaries, what to do about getting out of Iraq, et cetera. I mean, the things that he actually drew differences with other candidates on tended to be national security issues, and I think that's a reflection of where what he considers actually a strength of his and where his one of his preferences.
Samantha Powers, we have a clip from October of last year where Barack Obama laid out some of his defense priorities. Maybe we can listen to it.
I will cut tens of billions of dollars in wasteful spending. I will cut investments in unproven missile defense systems. I will not weaponize space. I will slow our development of future combat systems. And I will institute an independent Defense Priorities Board to ensure that the quadrennial defense review is not used to justify unnecessary spending. Third, I will set a goal of a world without nuclear weapons. To seek that goal, I will not develop new nuclear weapons. I will seek a global ban on the production of fissile material, and I will negotiate with Russia to take our ICBMs off hair trigger alert and to achieve deep cuts in our nuclear arsenals.
And many on the right have seized on those proposals as part of an effort to suggest Barack Obama is soft on defense.
Well, again, that was another issue that I could have added to the list of distinct national security policies that set him apart, I think, from other candidates. He came right out, again, when there were some who would have been whispering in his ear, not in his inner circle, certainly, or in the campaign, but, you know, saying, hey, do you really want to say you're for a world without nuclear weapons? And, you know, he said, well, yeah. In fact, that is, you know, I'm not going to disarm unilaterally, but that is the world that we want to live in. And it should be noted that George Shultz and Sam Nunn and some very respected national security heavyweights, you know, are in very much the same camp and are part of that initiative. So I think, you know, the right.
You don't think he's going to backtrack, Samantha?
I don't think he's going to backtrack, no. And I think some of what's being characterized as backtracking on other issues is, in fact, congressional compromise or is, in fact, you know, people actually getting to know the substance of his positions better than they'd known it before. But is it a very delicate dance a national election race on these questions of national security when voters have become so habituated to equating the threats of military force with alleged toughness? Yes, it's a dance. Are there risks inherent inherent in talking about disarmament. People feel that there are threats out there. Of course, there are risks, but it's also important to have a policy platform that is distinct and principled and reflective of your views. And again, on the nuclear issues, he is in very cluttered company, even in the national security community, in terms of what a desirable end state is, even though there are differences on tactics and in terms of how to get there.
I'm talking with Pulitzer Prize winner, former Obama campaign advisor Samantha Power. She's written an article that's in the current issue of the New York Review of Books called Democrats and National Security. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Samantha Power, who's written an article in the latest edition of the New York Review of Books called Democrats and National Security. I wonder, Samantha, if you think that part of the debate in this election will reflect a generational difference that might apply to people who didn't live through Vietnam or don't have as strong a memory of the debates of that time.
Well, that's an argument Obama has made consistently, that in embodying change, part of the change that he's trying to embody is to get away from these false dichotomies and these false choices of yesteryear, between war on the one hand and appeasement on the other, to take one caricature of a position that favors negotiation and diplomacy and so forth. I think there are a lot of different generations at work in this election. Of course, part of what is driving his success thus far in the election is young voters. And, some of the people who will be able to vote in this election were 10 years old even during 9/11. There are people who sort of have to be brought into engaging in the idea of national security at all. People who, in their horror at what's gone down in the last 8 years in terms of the war in Iraq and the increase in the number of people who join terrorist organizations and seek to do Americans harm, part of their frustration with the democracy agenda, which has proven much more rhetoric than real, part of the temptation, according to poll data, in the Democratic base is to come home and not only just to focus on the economy, but actually to mind our own business in international affairs. And so one of the challenges for the next president, hopefully the next Democratic president, Barack Obama, will be actually convincing people that we can't stay home in the 21st century, that there has to be American engagement, and that part of our recovery of our standing and our respect in the world is about rooting that engagement in principles that Americans can embrace. But without that, we're not going to deal with global warming. We are going to have to deal with terrorism. We're not going to be able to get out of Iraq with the help of other countries, et cetera. The options in the year 2008 are not engage or not engage, but rather how to engage and, again, with what principles undergirding that engagement.
Well, let's talk a bit about Iraq. John McCain often claims that Barack Obama's Iraq proposals amount to embracing defeat. How do you think the Obama campaign can effectively combat that kind of charge?
Well, this has been a device employed by many, many conservatives over the years, and it was something that was said for years about Vietnam, and it was something that deterred American leaders from getting out of Vietnam probably when they should have, it was something that should have deterred them, of course, from getting in the first place. I think Obama has a successful strategy for combating this argument. Number one, it's to push back and pull up from Iraq and to talk about the strategic harm that being in Iraq causes us, to quote U.S. generals on the fact that the U.S. military is at its breaking point when you have young men and women on their fourth and fifth tours, to point to the fact, sadly, tragically, that more Americans died in Afghanistan, more Americans and allied soldiers died in Afghanistan in the month of June than in Iraq, that, in putting troops into Iraq and in maintaining this fiction that this is a war that can be won, we're doing ourselves a great disservice on the most meaningful front in the so-called war on terror. So pushing back, at the larger cost and pointing to the harm that the invasion of Iraq and the ongoing occupation of Iraq has done in terms of our efforts to combat terrorism, the fodder, the recruitment fodder that our presence there has offered, terrorist networks, not just Al-Qaeda, but a lot of its copycat cousins. push, you know, pull up. Don't stay in the weeds on Iraq. Don't argue as much about tactics, although you have to respond to the outrageous charges sometimes made by the McCain campaign. But be prepared also to say, let's look at the big picture here in terms of U.S. national security and come back, of course, to the fact that this is a war that should never have been fought.
Well, there are many people.
The first place.
There are many people who will concede now, some who supported the war originally, that the war was a mistake, or at least the way we proceeded in it. But they also say that leaving would have an almost apocalyptic consequences, and we would be leaving a much bigger mess than we even entered.
Yeah, I you hear that argument a lot. It's, I think, with, if you're John McCain, I mean, think about it, the status quo in terms of American national security, you know, the ever-worsening situation in Afghanistan, the enhanced recruitment possibilities for al-Qaeda as a result of the war in Iraq, the, you know, bad news that comes from Iraq every day, even though the violence is down, you know, Americans still dying, Iraqis still dying, failure to reach political consensus on things. So if you're John McCain, you've got to paint an even grimmer picture about what the future will hold if you change the status quo. So the status quo is sufficiently bad, you've got to paint a doomsday scenario. I think it would be a mistake on the part of Democrats to simply say, oh, no, well, there aren't going to be any bad consequences of leaving, and we know that because we have a crystal ball. I think one can point to the fact that the same people who are warning of Rwanda-like genocide in the wake of U.S. withdrawal are the ones who said it would be a cakewalk on the way in. And so, you know, their predictive capacities, I think, are quite limited, demonstrably limited by their recent track record. But it's important to actually talk about how we are going to mitigate the you know, any potential harmful consequences in leaving. And one of the, I think, disappointing aspects of this campaign so far is Obama made a very detailed speech about this now going on a year ago, in which he talked about, you know, $2 billion in refugee assistance to neighboring countries to try to get them to open up their borders, assistance to the internally displaced, fair notice to Iraqi leaders so that you, you know, as you think tactically about how to get out and at what pace, in which neighborhoods and so forth, you're actually doing it in consultation to people whose fates are hanging in the balance, potentially even relocating people who want to be relocated from mixed neighborhoods, tragically, to homogenous neighborhoods. I mean, you know, to actually address the charge of the apocalypse, not by saying, no, there won't, but actually by saying, you know, I didn't want this war. I opposed this war from the beginning, unlike you, who advocated it and has been for it all along. But believe me, I will be a responsible commander-in-chief. Not only will I not send U.S. soldiers into unnecessary wars as this one was, but in getting out, I will be far more careful than you and the Bush administration were getting in. And I think, to pivot away from the conversation and to kind of say those consequences won't happen, you know, most Americans know that we can't predict precisely what will happen on a given day, but we do know the costs of actually staying, the ongoing consequences of staying. So again, continuing to remind people of just how broken the U.S. military is beginning to feel and how dangerous that is long term.
Samantha Power is my guest. She has written an article on what the Democrats should do about national security in the current issue of the New York Review of Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you think the media play a role in perpetuating the idea that the Republicans are better than Democrats on defense issue and national security? Because you write, the images of John Kerry as a hunter were greeted with greater ridicule than that of George W. Bush wearing a flight suit and staging a landing on the USS Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier off the coast of California. Well, that has been pretty much ridiculed ever since. But why do you think the press has, at least in your perception, been kinder to the Republicans than the Democrats in this regard?
Well, I suppose the press is comprised of citizens, you know, and just as citizens have brought this, call it a bias or impression, to their thinking about the two parties, I think most journalists bring the, you know, analogous sets of impressions. I was stunned in researching this piece to actually look at the poll data over the course of the last, the last four decades, but really over the last, also specifically over the last 4 years, to see that, in fact, you know, while the Republicans had this 30-point edge on national security throughout the 1990s, they maintained that edge through Bush's first term, even increased it in the wake, of course, of 9/11. To see the degree to which the war in Iraq began to chip away at that Republican lead, and culminating in 2006 in the Democrats taking their first edge in terms of public confidence for them to handle the war in Iraq, and a few months later actually surpassing Republicans on handling national security more generally. Now, that doesn't speak, again, to the Obama-McCain polls that exist right now, but it was interesting that all the way back in 2006, Democrats crossed that threshold, and perversely, because Bush elided 9/11 and the war on terror, as he calls it, with Saddam Hussein, the fact that Iraq was going so badly made Americans who kind of bought the elision between the two, it caused Americans to say, oh, well, then the war on terror is going very badly, too. So Republicans and the president began to suffer in terms of public standing. Well, I had no awareness of that shift in public attitudes on national security more generally until I went and kind of looked specifically at the poll data. So I think it's interesting that it wasn't itself newsworthy. And I think, you know, the more that we, again, create these narratives, it becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy where everything is filtered through this this prism of believing, you know, when Bush says something about threatening Iran and so forth, that that is what Americans want to hear. Well, when one of the other interesting polls that came out quite recently was showing how many Americans, I think two-thirds of Americans, support Obama's idea of actually engaging with regimes that have been considered our adversaries. That was surprising and, again, didn't get very much media coverage. So I think journalists have to do a better job actually studying what the American people are saying, largely in response to the last 8 years, which they haven't liked very much.
In the primaries, Hillary Clinton often made the argument that she was more prepared on national security issues than Barack Obama. Do you think the Clinton campaign's 3 a.m. ad was effective in making voters doubt Obama's national security credentials?
Well, he pushed back on that and obviously is in the position he's in now because it wasn't lastingly damaging. I think, you know, his trip abroad showed Americans, you know, him meeting with heads of state. A lot of people said, oh, the trip was a mistake. You know, polls went down briefly, you know, for a few days while he was away. And certainly McCain, tried to criticize him for going abroad and for how he went abroad. But I think, you know, there's no question that those images of him meeting with Sarkozy and meeting with Gordon Brown and David Cameron sink into people's, memory banks, and they start to see him in the kind of head of state category. A crucial step, though, that I think Democrats still have to take, or at least I don't think it's quite registered yet with independent voters and even with many Democrats, is for voters to actually look at that crowd of 200,000 people in Germany and not simply say, hey, isn't it great that Obama can draw that kind of crowd or that he generates that kind of hope, but to actually take the next step and to say, you know what, in the 21st century, we're not actually going to be able to draw other countries to our side to deal with threats that cross borders, whether global warming or nuclear proliferation or terrorism, you name it. I mean, so many of the 21st century threats do cross borders, unless we have public and political support, in other countries. And so that it's not simply a feel-good image. It's not simply important for our souls that we right the balance and restore American credibility and do away with this anti-Americanism, but it has actual national security and strategic consequences to do so.
Well,
that's the leap we have to make.
Can't meeting with foreign journalists also be dangerous? Are you willing to address the news story involving Hillary Clinton that led you to leave the Obama campaign?
I can address it in the sense that it was the stupidest and most misleading words or quotes that's ever come out of my mouth. I mean, it can be dangerous if you're an idiot like I was, but I don't think...
That also points up the fact that we're really into gotcha mode, aren't we, in political campaigns?
Yes. I mean, I think it's the responsibility of the responsible, policy advisor, whatever, to not, say things that they immediately regret and so forth. But yes, I mean, is there a distorting, leave my circumstances, out of it, where I think I'm 100% responsible for my plight. But I think there are occasions, certainly, when foreign journalists are just in there, wanting to trip you up. I mean, I think even Senator Clinton, when she was asked to pronounce the name of the new Russian prime minister, that was an example of just trying to nail you know, the candidates, nail their advisors. But, you know, on the other hand, this is the big leagues, and people who are preparing to govern, especially given the challenges they're going to be handed in January of 2009, probably, you know, have to put themselves in a position to be able to handle that kind of gotcha journalism, because it's just it's certainly what they're going to have to deal with when they're actually in charge.
Now, we have just about a minute to go, but over the course of the 2004 election, the color-coded terror alert system was raised several times, and some people suggested that the system was abused to stoke up fear for political gain. If that's true, what's to keep such a tactic from being employed again during this election cycle?
Well, I think everything's possible. I mean, there is a ruthlessness, in this election that we're already starting to see is very, very disturbing, and not very honorable, unfortunately, I think, on the Republican side. But, you know, I think Senator Obama has had the advantage of watching the Al Gore effort in 2000, of watching very closely and carefully the 2004 election. I think he knows what's coming. He has a rapid response team in place, you know, that has been drinking water from a fire hose of late, given all that's been thrown at it. But, you know, the American people also have been, I think, conditioned by the last 8 years, and given the level of unpopularity of the current president and of his policies, crucially, which are policies by and large supported by John McCain, I believe that they're smart enough at this stage to see through that and not be guided yet again by the politics of fear, which have been so harmful for our security.
And you suggest in the article that the Democrats should go on the offensive in this case rather than just respond.
Yes, and I think it's difficult for Obama alone to do this because, you know, his job is also to convince people that he's got the answer on the economy and on the environment and the other issues that he's been talking about since he's returned. But we have a whole Democratic Party apparatus that can be out there showing, and it's, in some ways it's as much about the music
as
the lyrics.
I have to leave it there, unfortunately. Samantha Power, Pulitzer Prize winner, her article in the New York Review of Books, Democrats and National Security. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.